Okay, strap yourselves in. Today, we're diving deep into the wild world of aeromedical factors.
Oh, yeah.
You're curious about what keeps pilots and passengers healthy in the air?
Right.
And we've got a stack of training materials to help us unpack this fascinating subject.
It's incredible how interconnected everything is when you're talking about flying.
Yeah.
You know, we'll be exploring how obtaining a medical certificate is just the tip of the iceberg,
Right.
and how your body's reaction to altitude scuba diving, even a simple cold,
Yeah.
can all come into play thousands of feet up.
It's one thing to ace a flight simulator,
Right.
but keeping your body happy and healthy in those conditions is
Yeah.
a whole other challenge.
Totally.
So first up, medical certificates.
Okay.
It's not as simple as walking into a doctor's office, is it?
Not quite. You see, a medical certificate is more than just a checkup. It's your golden ticket, proving you're fit to fly.
Okay.
The FAA's priority is safety. So they want to ensure every pilot is up to the task.
Right.
Think of it as a specialized evaluation process,
yeah,
tailored to the unique demands of aviation.
Makes sense. And there are different levels to this, right? It's
Yes.
not one size fits all.
You got it. It's tiered first, second, and third class certificates.
Okay.
The higher you go, the greater the responsibility. So think airline captain versus weekend hobbyist.
Right.
And the more stringent the medical requirements become.
So first class is the most demanding then. Who needs that one?
First class is for the pilots of those massive passenger jets you see cruising across continents. It's the top tier reserved for airline transport pilots demanding peak physical and mental condition.
Then there's second class, right?
Exactly. Second class is essential for commercial pilots and those acting as second in command on those larger flights, demanding a high level of medical fitness as well.
And third class.
Yep.
That's where most recreational pilots would fall, right?
Precisely. If you're a private or recreational pilot, a student pilot just starting, or even a certified flight instructor, you'd need a third-class medical certificate.
So you've piqued my curiosity. Where do you even begin to get one of these certificates? Do you need to go on a special quest to find an aviation doctor hidden in a hangar somewhere?
It's not quite that dramatic. You need to find an aviation medical examiner, often referred to as an AME.
AME, got it. But finding one can't be as easy as Googling doctor, right?
Actually, it's easier than you might think. Your local flight standards district offices, those are the FSDOs, usually have them. Also check out flight service stations, FSS's regular FAA offices, or just hop on the FAA website. They've got a tool to locate AMEs in your area.
That's good to know. It's not as daunting as I pictured. Now, let's say someone is concerned about a pre-existing medical condition.
Okay.
Is it even possible to fly if you've got something in your medical history that might be a red flag?
That's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
It's a common misconception that any health hiccup automatically grounds you. You see, FR 61.53, one of those all-important aviation regulations, says you can't fly if you know you have a disqualifying medical condition.
Okay, so far so good. But I've heard whispers of pilots flying with certain conditions.
Right.
Is there some kind of aviation magic trick to make this happen?
That's where things get nuanced. You're right, there are exceptions. Let's say a pilot has physical limitations.
Okay.
They might be issued a student privileges only certificate.
Okay.
They can still learn and enjoy flying, potentially, even with special equipment installed in the aircraft, but it wouldn't be for commercial purposes.
So their dreams aren't dashed, but there's an asterisk next to their pilot's license.
Exactly. Or let's say a pilot has a condition but can demonstrate they can fly safely with it.
Okay.
They might be granted a statement of demonstrated ability.
Yeah.
Sometimes called a SOTA.
Okay.
It's like the FAA saying, we trust you've got this.
That's amazing. So there's hope for aspiring pilots who thought their medical history might keep them grounded.
Right.
But I imagine there are some hard limits, right? Certain conditions where it's just too risky.
Absolutely. Safety is paramount. And the FAA has a list of 15 specific conditions that are typically disqualifying. You can find it on their website. They're transparent about it.
Okay.
It underscores that while there's flexibility, some risks are non-negotiable.
Transparency is good, especially when it comes to safety. Now, we've been talking about the traditional medical certification process, but what about this basic med I've heard whispers about in the hangar?
Basic med. It's like a new route on the aviation map, allowing pilots to operate certain aircraft without needing a traditional FAA medical certificate.
Sounds intriguing. Give us the lowdown. What's the catch?
Well, it's not a free pass. Think of it as trading some freedoms for a potentially smoother journey.
Yeah. You
still need a medical exam every 4 years, have to complete a specialized medical education course, and there are limitations on the aircraft and operations.
So more accessible in some ways.
Yeah.
But with its own set of rules.
Precisely. It's opening doors for many aspiring pilots. which is fantastic.
Yeah.
However, understanding the specific requirements and limitations is crucial. Knowledge is power, even in the clouds.
Speaking of limitations, let's talk about something every pilot and really anyone stepping on a plane should be aware of.
Okay.
Hypoxia.
Okay.
It sounds a bit like a mythical creature, doesn't it?
That does sound a bit ominous, right? In reality, it's a very real concern for pilots. Hypoxia is a lack of sufficient oxygen, which becomes more likely at higher altitudes. Imagine your body gasping for air, but instead of holding your breath, it's the air itself that's changing.
We breathe perfectly fine on the ground, so why is altitude such a game changer? It's all about air pressure, that invisible force we often take for granted. As you climb higher, the air pressure drops, and so does the availability of oxygen. It's like trying to breathe through a straw. Your body has to work harder to get the same amount of oxygen.
So it's not just a pilot issue. Then passengers can experience hypoxia too.
Absolutely. Anyone on board can be affected. Recognizing the symptoms is crucial for everyone venturing above the clouds.
All right, give it to me straight. What are the warning signs?
The first symptom is often a sense of euphoria, a carefree feeling. That might sound pleasant, but it's actually a red flag.
Wait, seriously? It sounds almost enjoyable.
It's counterintuitive, right? That's what makes hypoxia so dangerous. It can lull you into a false sense of security, like a siren song in the sky.
And if those warning signs are ignored, what happens next?
Things can escalate quickly. You might notice a bluish tint to your fingernails and lips. That's cyanosis, a sure sign your body is starved for oxygen. Then come the headaches, decreased reaction times, and impaired judgment.
Not exactly the ideal state for anyone, let alone someone responsible for a plane full of people.
Precisely. And as if that wasn't enough, hypoxia can also cause euphoria, visual impairment, drowsiness, lightheadedness, tingling sensations, and even numbness. It's a whole cascade of problems.
Yikes. That sounds like a recipe for disaster. Does altitude play a role in how quickly these symptoms hit?
Altitude is a major factor. The higher you climb, the faster hypoxia sets in, leaving less time to react. At 45,000 feet, you might have as little as 9 to 15 seconds of useful consciousness.
9 to 15 seconds? That's barely enough time to react, let alone make life or death decisions.
It's a stark reminder of how critical it is to understand hypoxia. At lower altitudes, say 20,000 feet, you've got a bit more time, around 30 minutes or more. But every second counts when your brain isn't getting enough oxygen.
Okay, this is some seriously important stuff. So we know the symptoms, we know altitude is a factor. But what can you actually do about hypoxia if it happens? Is there an in-flight antidote?
The solution is surprisingly straightforward. First and foremost, descend to a lower altitude where the air is richer in oxygen. Think of it as a controlled freefall, back to breathable air.
Okay.
Second, if available, use supplemental oxygen. It's like giving your body a direct line to the oxygen it desperately needs.
Supplemental oxygen. It's like a breath of fresh air, literally. It makes sense. That's a vital tool in a pilot's arsenal.
Exactly. It's like having an emergency oxygen bar at 30,000 feet.
Now that's a business idea I can get behind. But in all seriousness, hypoxia is nothing to mess with. Speaking of things that mess with your body in the air, let's talk about hyperventilation.
Okay.
It's basically the opposite of hypoxia, right?
They're on the right track.
Yep.
While hypoxia is about not having enough oxygen, hyperventilation is about expelling carbon dioxide too quickly.
Okay.
Disrupting the body's delicate balance.
So picture this. You're cruising at altitude. Maybe some light turbulence is making you a bit queasy.
Right.
Could that trigger hyperventilation?
It absolutely could. Emotional stress, whether from turbulence and near miss or even just a general anxiety of flying, can definitely lead to hyperventilation.
Yeah.
Pain or a sudden fright can do it too. It's your body going into overdrive when it doesn't need to.
And for pilots who are already dealing with the demands of flying, it seems like hyperventilation could be especially dangerous.
Precisely. They're laser focused on their instruments navigating the skies, and suddenly their body throws this curveball. Recognizing the symptoms is crucial because they can mimic hypoxia.
Okay, now I'm really interested. What are the telltale signs?
Think back to the symptoms of hypoxia. Visual impairment, lightheadedness, tingling sensations, hot and cold flashes, muscle spasms, and in severe cases, even unconsciousness.
So it's easy to see how a pilot might mistake hyperventilation for hypoxia. They both sound pretty scary.
You're hitting on a critical point. Regardless of whether it's hypoxia or hyperventilation, the first line of defense is the same: regain control of your breathing.
Easier said than done when you're thousands of feet in the air, right?
True, but there are techniques. Deliberately slowing down your breathing is key. One method is to breathe into a paper bag. It helps reintroduce some of that lost carbon dioxide.
That's one use for those air sickness bags I hadn't considered. Are there any other in-flight breathing exercises that can help?
You got it. Even talking out loud or singing can work wonders. Anything that helps establish a regular breathing pattern. It's all about calming those overactive lungs.
So breathe slow and sing a tune. I'll keep that in mind. Now on to a more relatable issue, ear pressure. I think we've all experienced that uncomfortable feeling during ascent or descent. What's the science behind those popping ears?
It all boils
down. We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Down to air pressure and those fascinating little pockets inside our heads. The air pressure inside your middle ear, that's the space behind your eardrum, needs to equalize with the pressure in the cabin.
And when the pressure outside changes quickly, like during a steep climb or descent,
right,
our ears can't keep up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That difference in pressure causes the eardrum to stretch, leading to that uncomfortable or even painful popping sensation.
So it's like a mini tug of war going on inside our ears. What's the best way to win that battle and get those ears to pop?
Ah, the age-old question. Chewing gum or yawning often does the trick. They both activate muscles that open the eustachian tube, a tiny passageway connecting your middle ear to the back of your throat.
And that allows air to flow more easily, equalizing the pressure. What if those methods don't cut it?
Try the Valsalva maneuver.
Okay.
Pinch your nostrils shut.
Yeah.
Close your mouth and gently try to blow air out your nose.
I've definitely used that one before, usually with a sigh of relief when it works. Now let's clear the air and talk about another pressure-related issue that can really put a damper on flying sinus problems.
Oh yeah, sinus issues and flying don't mix well. Those tiny openings in your sinuses, the ones responsible for equalizing pressure, can become easily blocked when you have a cold, making it incredibly painful during descent.
That sounds awful. Is there anything pilots or passengers can do to avoid that pressurized pain in the face?
Maintaining a slow descent rate can make a world of difference.
Yeah.
It gives your sinuses more time to adjust. And if you're prone to sinus issues or have a cold talk to your doctor before flying, especially if you'll be at higher altitudes.
Always good to consult the experts. Okay, ready for this next one? It sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi movie, spatial disorientation. Is it as intense as it sounds?
It can be. Imagine this. You're flying in perfect visibility, blue skies all around.
Okay.
Yet your brain tells you the plane is banking, turning, even diving. Your senses are essentially playing tricks on you.
That sounds incredibly disorienting. How does that even happen?
Our bodies rely on three main systems to figure out where we are in space.
Okay.
You have your visual system, what you see, your somatosensory system, information from your skin, muscles, and joints.
Okay.
And your vestibular system, that's your inner ear, responsible for balance and spatial orientation.
Okay, I'm following so far. We've got our eyes, our sense of touch, and our inner ear all working together to keep us oriented.
Exactly. But in flight, especially when visual cues are limited, these systems can send conflicting messages to your brain, leading to spatial disorientation. It's like your internal GPS is on the fritz.
So our senses, which usually keep us grounded, can actually mislead us in the air.
You got it. And when it comes to spatial disorientation, your inner ear, specifically those vestibular organs, can be easily fooled.
This is where those fascinating semicircular canals come into play, right?
Exactly. Imagine tiny fluid-filled hula hoops inside your ears.
Okay.
As your head rotates, the fluid sloshes around, stimulating hair cells that send signals to your brain telling you which way you're turning.
So our inner ear is like a built-in gyroscope.
That's a great way to put it. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Those hair cells adapt to sustained motion. If you're in a prolonged turn after about 20 seconds, the fluid stops moving relative to the canal, and you no longer sense the turn.
Wait, so your body basically gets used to the feeling of turning?
Right.
Even though you're still in a turn.
That's the tricky part. Your brain starts to think you're flying straight and level even when you're not.
Okay, I can see how that could lead to some serious problems, especially if a pilot isn't paying close attention to their instruments.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here's another layer to the confusion. When the aircraft returns to level flight, the fluid in those canals briefly moves in the opposite direction.
Yeah, wow.
Making you feel like you're turning the other way.
So it's like a sensory hangover from the original turn.
That's a great way to put it. It's a classic example of how our senses which are usually trustworthy on the ground, can become our worst enemies in the air.
It makes you realize how crucial instrument training is for pilots.
Absolutely. Mm. In those moments when your body is sending mixed signals, instruments become your lifeline, providing a clear and objective picture of your true position and motion.
Trusting your instruments when your body is telling you otherwise, that takes training and a lot of mental discipline. Speaking of things that can mess with your head in the air, let's talk about motion sickness.
Right.
It's more than just an upset stomach, right?
It's a common misconception that motion sickness is all in your head.
Yeah.
In reality, it's a physiological response triggered by conflicting sensory information.
Okay.
Remember those three systems we talked about? Visual, somatosensory, and vestibular?
Right.
When they send mismatched signals to your brain, it can lead to nausea, dizziness, and a whole lot of discomfort.
So your brain is basically getting bombarded with conflicting information, and it doesn't know what to believe.
Yeah.
No wonder it leads to feeling queasy.
Exactly.
No.
Now imagine you're a passenger on a bumpy flight. Your inner ear senses the motion. Those hula hoop canals are working overtime.
Right.
But your eyes fixed on a book or a screen tell your brain you're stationary. That disconnect is a recipe for motion sickness.
That makes a lot of sense. So what can you do about it? Are there any in-flight hacks to combat motion sickness?
Absolutely. One of the simplest yet most effective techniques is to establish a stable visual reference point. Look out the window and focus on the horizon or a distant object. It helps reconcile those conflicting sensory inputs.
So put down the book and look outside. Are there any other strategies that can help?
Fresh air can work wonders. Ask a flight attendant to open an air vent, or if you're the pilot, adjust the ventilation system.
It's like that moment you roll down the car window on a winding road. Fresh air, nature's remedy.
Exactly. And here's one for the pilots. Smooth flying is key. Avoid abrupt maneuvers whenever possible. The smoother the flight, the happier your passenger stomachs will be.
It sounds like a win-win smoother flying for everyone on board. Now, you might think letting someone else take the controls would help with motion sickness.
Right.
But you've hinted that it might actually make things worse. Why is that?
When you're the one in control, your brain can anticipate the movements, making them less jarring. It's like knowing when to brace yourself for a bump in the road. You have a sense of control over the situation, which can reduce motion sickness.
So sometimes being in the driver's seat, or should I say pilot seat, is the best medicine.
Precisely. And there's good news for those learning to fly. Motion sickness often diminishes with experience.
That's encouraging. So power through those initial flights and your body will eventually adapt.
Exactly. As you become more comfortable in the air, your brain gets better at processing those sensory inputs, and motion sickness becomes less of an issue.
That's reassuring for aspiring pilots who might be worried about getting queasy in the cockpit. Now let's shift gears and talk about a hidden danger in aviation, one you can't see or smell, carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah.
How does this silent threat even become a risk in the air?
Carbon monoxide, or CO, is a byproduct of combustion. It's produced by engines, heaters, and any device that burns fuel.
Right.
In aviation, the risk arises if there's a leak in the exhaust system, allowing CO to seep into the cabin.
And because it's colorless and odorless, you wouldn't even know it's there until it's too late.
That's the scary part. It's a silent, insidious threat.
How does carbon monoxide affect the body?
CO is a master of disguise. It binds to hemoglobin in your blood, the molecule responsible for carrying oxygen with a much stronger affinity than oxygen.
Yeah.
This prevents oxygen from reaching your cells, essentially suffocating them from the inside out.
So even if you're breathing in plenty of oxygen, it can't get where it needs to go because the CO has hogged all the transportation.
That's a great way to put it.
We talked earlier about different types of hypoxia. Where does CO poisoning fit into that picture?
CO poisoning falls under the category of hyponemic hypoxia, where the blood's capacity to carry oxygen is compromised.
It's like sabotaging the delivery trucks, even if the oxygen warehouse is full.
Exactly. And here's the kicker. CO poisoning can have lasting effects. Your body can take up to 48 hours to eliminate CO completely.
So even mild exposure can have lingering consequences.
That's right. It's not something to take lightly.
This all makes recognizing the symptoms even more important. What should we be watching out for?
The early signs of CO poisoning are often mistaken for something else, like the flu or even fatigue. Headaches are common, as are dizziness, blurred vision, drowsiness, and a general feeling of weakness.
Easy to brush off, especially if you've been traveling or haven't been sleeping well.
Exactly. That's why it's crucial to be extra vigilant if you experience these symptoms during or after a flight.
So let's say you're a pilot and you suspect CO might be lurking in the cockpit. What do you do?
It's time for immediate action. Turn off the heater, Open fresh air vents or windows if possible. Use supplemental oxygen if you have it.
Yeah.
And land as soon as possible.
Those steps could mean the difference between life and death?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Never take chances with CO. If you even suspect it might be present, treat it as a serious emergency.
Great advice. Now let's talk about two other factors that can really impact your performance in the air and in life. Fatigue and stress.
Yeah, fatigue, whether it's from lack of sleep, physical exertion, or mental strain, can significantly impair your cognitive abilities and reaction time.
We've all been there, that sluggish feeling after a poor night's sleep when you can barely string a sentence together, let alone make critical decisions while flying a plane.
Exactly. And stress, that constant companion in today's fast-paced world, can exacerbate fatigue and lead to poor judgment, decreased attention span, and even difficulty communicating effectively.
So it's like a vicious cycle. Fatigue feeds stress, which in turn leads to more fatigue. And for pilots who are already dealing with the inherent demands of flying, those effects can be amplified.
Absolutely. They need to be firing on all cylinders, both mentally and physically.
What are some of the most common sources of fatigue and stress for pilots?
Long flights, irregular schedules, jet lag, sleep disturbances, noise, vibration. These are just a few of the occupational hazards.
It's like an endurance test even for the most seasoned pilots.
It is. And let's not forget the pressure they face. They're responsible for the safety of hundreds of passengers and millions of dollars worth of equipment. That could weigh heavily on anyone.
No pressure, right? So what can pilots do to manage fatigue and stress? Are there any in-flight meditation techniques or stress balls in the cockpit?
I wish it were that simple.
Right.
Seriously, though, managing fatigue starts long before you step into the cockpit.
So it's about prioritizing a healthy lifestyle on the ground to prepare for the demands of the air.
You got it. Getting adequate sleep, maintaining a regular sleep schedule, staying hydrated, eating a balanced diet, and incorporating regular exercise are all crucial.
It's those foundational elements of well-being that often get overlooked.
They do, but they're the building blocks of a healthy and resilient pilot.
Okay, so we've covered the importance of sleep, hydration, diet, and exercise. What about stress management? Are there any specific techniques pilots can use to stay calm under pressure?
Absolutely. Relaxation techniques like deep breathing meditation and mindfulness can be incredibly helpful both on the ground and in the air.
I can see how taking a few deep breaths before takeoff or during a stressful situation could make a world of difference.
It really can. And don't underestimate the power of communication. Talking to someone you trust, a fellow pilot, a family member, a therapist, can help you process stressful events and develop healthy coping mechanisms.
It's that age-old advice of talking it out, seeking support, and not bottling things up.
Exactly. Remember, even Superman has his fortress of solitude.
Now that's an image I won't soon forget. Speaking of things we need to stay on top of, let's talk about dehydration, a sneaky threat that can creep up on you, especially in those dry cabin conditions.
You're right. Dehydration is often overlooked, but it can have a significant impact on your physical and cognitive performance, especially at altitude.
We know staying hydrated is crucial for our health, but why is it especially important when you're flying?
The air inside an aircraft cabin is much drier than the air we're used to at sea level.
Okay.
This dry air, combined with the diuretic effects of caffeine and alcohol things many people consume when traveling, can lead to rapid dehydration.
It's like being in a giant flying dehumidifier. So imagine this. You've just flown across a few time zones, indulged in a couple of those mini bottles of wine, and now you're feeling sluggish and headachy. Could dehydration be the culprit?
Quite possibly. Those are all classic symptoms of dehydration. Fatigue is often the first sign, followed by headaches, dizziness, muscle cramps, and even difficulty concentrating.
So how much water should you actually be drinking when you fly? Is it the same 8 glasses a day we hear about on the ground?
The rule of thumb for staying hydrated in the air is to drink about 8 ounces of water every hour. That might seem like a lot. But remember, you're constantly losing fluids through breathing, especially in that dry cabin air.
And those tiny airplane bathrooms suddenly seem a lot less appealing when you're chugging water every hour.
That's the trade-off. But seriously, good hydration is crucial for maintaining your energy levels, focus, and overall well-being on those long flights.
So next time you pack your carry-on, make sure to include an empty, reusable water bottle and fill it up once you're through security.
Exactly. And here's a pro tip. Avoid those sugary drinks and alcohol. They'll just dehydrate you further. Stick to water juice or herbal tea.
Hydration. It's the cheapest, easiest, and arguably most important thing you can do for your health in the air.
I couldn't agree more.
Now let's talk about a topic that's often a source of concern, especially for new pilots' medications.
Okay.
Is it ever okay to fly while taking medication?
It's a question that comes up frequently. And the answer, as with many things in aviation, is it depends.
There are so many medications out there, from over-the-counter pain relievers to prescription medications for chronic conditions. Where do you even begin to figure out what's safe to fly with?
The golden rule is this. Never fly while taking any medication, even seemingly harmless over-the-counter remedies, without first consulting with an aviation medical examiner, your AME.
Okay.
They are the experts when it comes to medications and their potential effects on your ability to fly safely.
So it's not enough to just read the warning label on the bottle or rely on the advice of your family doctor.
It's always best to err on the side of caution and seek guidance from an AME. They have specialized knowledge about how medications can affect your body at altitude, under pressure, and in the demanding environment of the cockpit.
What are some of the potential side effects of medications that could impair your ability to fly safely?
Medications can have a wide range of effects, and what might seem like a minor side effect on the ground can be amplified in the air. Drowsiness is a big one, as is dizziness, blurred vision, slowed reaction time, impaired judgment, and even changes in mood or behavior.
So something that makes you a little sleepy on the ground could turn you into a liability in the cockpit. What about pain relievers? Those seem pretty harmless.
You'd be surprised. Even over-the-counter pain relievers like ibuprofen can have unexpected effects at altitude. For example, ibuprofen is known to thin the blood, which could be a concern if you experience a sudden drop in cabin pressure.
I hadn't thought of that. It's a good reminder that even those everyday medications we take for granted can have a different impact when you're soaring through the air.
Exactly. Your body's physiology changes at altitude, so it only makes sense that medications might affect you differently as well.
So the message is clear. When in doubt, ask your AME. They can provide personalized guidance based on your individual medical history and the medications you're taking. Now, this next topic might seem completely unrelated to flying, but it turns out there's a surprising connection: scuba diving.
Interesting.
What do these two activities have to do with each other, and why is it important for pilots to be aware of the risks?
It's all about pressure, or more accurately, changes in pressure.
When
you scuba dive, your body absorbs nitrogen from the compressed air you breathe underwater. The deeper you dive, the more nitrogen your body absorbs.
So it's like your body becomes a sponge soaking up nitrogen under pressure.
Exactly. Now here's where the connection to flying comes in. As you ascend in an aircraft, the cabin pressure decreases. If you haven't allowed sufficient time for that excess nitrogen to leave your body after a dive, it can form bubbles in your bloodstream and tissues, much like bubbles forming in a bottle of soda when you open it too quickly.
And those nitrogen bubbles, they're not harmless like the ones in your soda, are they?
Not at all. Those bubbles can cause a range of symptoms, from mild joint pain to severe neurological problems. A condition known as decompression sickness, or DCS.
Decompression sickness, that's the one they call the bends, right?
That's the one.
Yeah.
It's a serious condition that can be extremely painful and in some cases even life-threatening.
So let's say you're a pilot who also enjoys exploring the underwater world. What's the recommended waiting period between diving and flying to avoid those nasty nitrogen bubbles?
The general rule of thumb is to wait at least 12 hours after a single no decompression dive before flying. If you've been diving multiple times or at greater depths, you'll need to wait even longer.
So it's always best to err on the side of caution and consult the diving tables or a dive computer to determine the appropriate surface interval before flying.
Absolutely. And if you experience any symptoms of DCS, even mild ones, seek medical attention immediately and inform your doctor that you've been diving recently.
Now, before we wrap up this section, let's talk about a crucial tool that every pilot should have in their pre-flight arsenal, the MSAFE checklist.
Right, the MSAFE checklist.
MSAFE is like a pilot's personal safety net, a way to assess their fitness to fly before every single flight.
Exactly.
What does MSAFE stand for and how does it work?
It's an easy-to-remember acronym that prompts you to ask yourself six crucial questions. Illness. Am I feeling sick? Do I have any symptoms that could affect my ability to fly safely?
Okay.
Medication. Am I taking any medications prescribed or over-the-counter that could impair my judgment or performance in the cockpit?
Okay.
Stress. Am I experiencing any unusual stress or emotional distress that could affect my concentration or decision-making?
Okay.
Alcohol. Have I consumed any alcohol within the past 8 hours? Am I below the legal blood alcohol limit for flying?
Right.
Fatigue?
Yeah.
Am I feeling tired or run down? Did I get enough sleep last night? Mm-hmm. Am I mentally and physically prepared for the demands of this flight?
Yeah.
And emotion eating. Am I emotionally stable? Have I eaten recently enough to maintain my energy levels throughout the flight?
MSAFE. It's simple, yet it covers such a wide range of factors that can affect pilot performance.
Exactly. And the beauty of MSAFE is that it's a personal assessment. It's about being honest with yourself and acknowledging any factors that might compromise your ability to fly safely.
So even if you have a current medical certificate and feel generally healthy, you still need to go through the InSafe checklist before each flight.
Absolutely. Think of it as a final safety check, a way to catch those day-to-day variables that might not be covered in a routine medical exam.
Right.
A medical certificate doesn't account for how you slept last night, the argument you had with your partner, or the lingering cold you're trying to shake.
It's like checking the engine oil before you start a road trip, even if you just had the car serviced. It's that extra layer of vigilance.
Exactly. And here's the key takeaway. InSafe is about taking responsibility for your own fitness to fly and making the responsible decision to stay on the ground if any of those boxes are checked.
So no matter how experienced you are as a pilot or how much you're looking forward to a particular flight, InSafe is non-negotiable. It's about prioritizing safety above all else.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Now let's dive into a sense that's paramount for flying. Vision pilots' eyes are constantly challenged in the air, facing unique hurdles that most of us don't encounter on the ground.
When I think of flying, I imagine those breathtaking views from above.
Right.
But I guess it's not always sunshine and rainbows up there.
That's right. Pilots have to contend with constantly changing light conditions, from the blinding glare of the sun reflecting off clouds to the pitch darkness of night flying. They need to be able to see clearly in a wide range of conditions.
And their eyes have to adapt quickly to those transitions, right? Going from bright sunlight to the shadowy interior of a cloud must be jarring.
Exactly. Their eyes are constantly adjusting, trying to make sense of those rapid shifts in luminance.
And then there's depth perception. It seems like judging distances accurately would be critical when you're landing a plane.
It's essential, but it can be surprisingly tricky at altitude. Think about it. When you're thousands of feet in the air, your usual depth cues the relative size of objects the way they overlap.
Right.
Become less reliable.
So things might appear closer or farther away than they actually are.
That's right. It's like your brain is trying to process a 3D world projected onto a 2D surface.
Yeah.
Add in factors like haze fog or even just the curvature of the Earth, and it's a recipe for visual illusions.
Are there any specific visual illusions that pilots need to be aware of?
There are a few that can really trip you up. One common one is called empty field myopia.
Empty field myopia. That sounds almost poetic. What is it?
It happens when you're flying over a vast, featureless landscape, like a desert or a large body of water. With nothing to focus on in the distance, your eyes tend to relax and focus at a closer range as if you were staring at a blank wall.
So even though you're surrounded by miles of open sky, your eyes are essentially stuck in close-up mode?
Exactly. And that can be dangerous because you're less likely to spot obstacles or other aircraft that are farther away. It's like your peripheral vision shrinks.
Yeah.
And your awareness of the surrounding airspace narrows.
So pilots need to be aware of this tendency and actively scan for objects at varying distances, even when it seems like there's nothing but empty space around them.
Exactly. It's about fighting that natural urge for your eyes to relax and actively engaging your visual system to maintain situational awareness.
What other visual tricks did the skies have up their sleeves?
Another illusion pilots need to watch out for is called false horizon.
Okay.
This one can be particularly treacherous because it messes with your perception of up and down.
That sounds disorienting. How does it work?
Imagine you're flying at night, or in conditions where the actual horizon is obscured by clouds or fog. Your brain, craving a reference point, might latch onto something else like a sloping cloud layer, a line of lights on the ground, or even just a particularly bright star.
And that false cue tricks your brain into thinking it's level even when it's not.
That's the danger. You might start adjusting your aircraft's attitude to align with this false horizon, unknowingly putting yourself into a dangerous position.
So it's another example of how important it is for pilots to trust their instruments even when their eyes are telling them otherwise.
Exactly. Those instruments, particularly the attitude indicator, provide an objective reference point that's not subject to the whims of our visual system.
Okay, so we've talked about visual challenges, but what about food? Does what you eat actually matter when you're up in the air?
You bet it does. Just like you wouldn't fuel your car with the wrong type of gasoline, what you eat has a direct impact on your energy levels, alertness, and cognitive function, all crucial for flying.
So it's not just about fitting into those airplane seats. It's about fueling your body for optimal performance in the cockpit?
That's right. It's all about making smart food choices to stay sharp and focused at the controls.
So what's on the menu for pilot-approved meals and snacks?
Think of it this way. You want to fuel your body for a long-haul flight, not a quick sugar rush followed by an inevitable crash.
So steer clear of those sugary drinks and processed snacks that leave you feeling sluggish and foggy-headed.
Exactly. They might provide a temporary energy boost, but you'll pay for it later with a crash in blood sugar that can impair your judgment and reaction time. Instead, focus on foods that provide sustained energy and support cognitive function.
Give us the goods. What are some pilot-friendly options?
Complex carbohydrates are your best friend.
Okay.
They break down slowly, providing a steady stream of energy. Think whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes. They're all packed with nutrients and fiber to keep you feeling full and focused.
So swap out those sugary cereals for a bowl of oatmeal with berries and ditch the candy bars for a handful of almonds or a piece of fruit.
Now you're getting it.
Yeah.
And don't forget about protein. It helps stabilize blood sugar levels, keeps you feeling full, and supports muscle mass.
Any recommendations for pilot-approved protein sources?
Lean meats, fish, eggs, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds are all great options.
Okay, so we've got our complex carbs and our protein covered. What about caffeine? Is that a go or a no-go for pilots?
Caffeine is a bit of a double-edged sword. In moderation, it can improve alertness and cognitive function, but too much can lead to anxiety jitters and even dehydration. Not exactly ideal when you're at the controls of an airplane.
So maybe one cup of coffee to get going in the morning, but lay off the energy drinks and those extra large lattes?
Exactly. And always make sure you're counteracting the dehydrating effects of caffeine by drinking plenty of water.
Hydration is key, whether you're on the ground or in the air. Now let's talk about timing. Does it matter when pilots eat, or is it more about what they eat?
Both are important.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you wouldn't want to run a marathon on an empty stomach. It's crucial for pilots to fuel their bodies regularly throughout the day, especially during those long flights.
So no skipping meals or trying to power through a transatlantic flight on just a cup of coffee and a bag of pretzels.
Definitely not. Aim for regular balanced meals and healthy snacks to maintain steady energy levels and prevent those energy dips that can lead to fatigue and impaired decision making.
Now I have to ask, what about those sudden drops and jolts that make your stomach lurch into your throat? We're talking, of course, about turbulence. What causes it? And what can pilots do to avoid it?
Turbulence. Every flyer's least favorite part of the journey.
Right.
It's a natural occurrence caused by disturbances in the atmosphere, like changes in wind speed or direction, temperature variations, even jet streams.
So it's like hitting a rough patch in the road, only you're thousands of feet in the air and there's nowhere to pull over.
That's a great analogy. And just like those bumpy roads, turbulence can range in severity from light shock to severe jolts that can momentarily toss the aircraft around.
Knowing what I know now about spatial disorientation and illusions, I can only imagine how unsettling it must be to experience turbulence when your senses are already a bit off kilter. What can pilots do to avoid turbulence, or at least minimize its effects?
Pilots have a few tricks up their sleeves. Weather radar is a lifesaver.
Oh, okay.
It allows them to see areas of potential turbulence ahead, much like you might check the traffic report before a road trip.
So if they spot a patch of rough air, they can try to navigate around it.
Exactly. They can also adjust their altitude or airspeed to try to find smoother conditions.
Yeah.
Sometimes climbing or descending just a few thousand feet can make all the difference.
It's like finding those back roads that bypass the traffic jams. Now, what about during takeoff and landing? Those phases of flight always seem a bit more intense, especially when it comes to turbulence.
You're right. Turbulence can be more common and potentially more hazardous during takeoffs and landings. This is often due to something called wind shear, sudden changes in wind speed or direction that can really rock the aircraft.
Wind shear sounds intense. Is that why pilots always seem so focused during takeoff and landing?
Exactly. They're on high alert, monitoring the wind conditions and making constant adjustments to keep the aircraft stable.
You mentioned earlier those sudden drops that feel like your stomach just jumped out of your seat. Are those also caused by wind shear?
Those stomach lurching moments are often caused by downdrafts, columns of sinking air that can occur even on seemingly clear days.
So even if the sky looks calm and peaceful, there could be invisible forces at play, ready to give you an unexpected thrill ride.
That's the thing about flying. You're at the mercy of the elements. That's why pilots are trained to anticipate these challenges and react quickly to keep everyone safe.
It makes you appreciate the skill and expertise required to navigate those invisible forces.
That's the thing about flying. You're at the mercy of the elements. That's why pilots are trained to anticipate these challenges and react quickly to keep everyone safe.
It makes you appreciate the skill and expertise required to navigate those invisible forces. This deep dive has been eye-opening. We've covered a ton of ground, from the importance of medical certificates and understanding how our bodies react to altitude to the hidden dangers of carbon monoxide and the crucial role of good nutrition. It's incredible how much goes into ensuring a safe and healthy flight.
It truly is a multifaceted endeavor involving a complex interplay of physiological, psychological, and environmental factors.
And it's not just about memorizing checklists and procedures. It's about understanding the why behind it all, right?
Precisely. Knowledge is power, especially in aviation. The more you understand about how your body and mind respond to the demands of flight, the better prepared you'll be to handle whatever challenges come your way.
Now, I'm curious, as we've gone through these aeromedical factors, is there anything that stood out to you as particularly important or surprising?
What fascinates me is how easily some of these conditions can mimic each other, leading to potentially dangerous misinterpretations. Take hypoxia and hyperventilation, for example. They share many of the same symptoms, yet they require opposite courses of action.
That's a great point. A pilot experiencing tingling sensations and lightheadedness might assume it's hypoxia and descend, when in reality they're hyperventilating and need to slow their breathing.
Exactly. That's why understanding the nuances of these conditions, recognizing the subtle differences in symptoms, and knowing how to respond appropriately is crucial.
It highlights the importance of thorough training, staying up to date on the latest research, and never underestimating the complexity of the human body, especially in the demanding environment of flight.
Couldn't agree more. It's a continuous learning process, and those who approach it with curiosity, humility, and a deep respect for the power of knowledge are the ones who truly excel in aviation.
As we wrap up our deep dive into aeromedical factors, is there one key takeaway you hope our listeners will carry with them?
Remember this. Flying is a privilege, not a right. It's a testament to human ingenuity and our ability to conquer the skies. But it's also a responsibility, a demand for constant vigilance, and a commitment to understanding the intricate ways our bodies and minds interact with the challenges of flight. By prioritizing your health, respecting the power of knowledge, and embracing a proactive approach to safety, you're not just ensuring a smoother journey, you're honoring the incredible feat of human flight itself.
Beautifully said. So to our listeners, as you plan your next adventure in the air, remember the insights we've explored today. Stay curious, stay informed, and most importantly, stay safe. Until next time, happy landings.